I'm John McKay, sitting in today for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, what makes a city truly great? Cleanliness? Excellent transportation? Nightlife? Have traffic jams and crime run families off to the suburbs? The new book, Metropolis, A History of the City, Humankind's Greatest Invention, takes a careful look at what cities have given us and taken from us over centuries, not just in the West, around the world. Author Ben Wilson joins us with some wide-ranging conclusions after this break. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm John McKay, sitting in today for Chris Boyd. Climate change, congestion, crime. People love to complain about cities, but every day, urban living around the world adds 200,000 people. And in his new book, Metropolis, A History of the City, Humankind's Greatest Invention, award-winning author Ben Wilson argues the benefits humanity has gleaned from cities throughout the history of civilization have been and continue to be staggering. He joins us now from the United Kingdom. Welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me. I'm delighted.
I want to start off by talking about, you mentioned in the beginning, urban settlements. How do you define that, an urban settlement?
Well, it's mainly, I think, with density. It's also a lot to do with a place that's organized around a place of public worship, a temple, and a place of power. So there were large human settlements before the first city, but the first city is kind of is organized as a city, as we would define it, around a temple, with people who work with their brain rather than their brawn, let's say, people who were thinkers rather than doers. So we'd see a city probably as a place of specialization, where people specialize in various trades and businesses. So a whole range of human activities. It isn't just around subsistence. It's around something that's bigger than the individual and bigger than in a more simple society. So I'd say that an urban area is defined by its complexity, which is probably a function of its density of population, which kind of brings people together into networks that become very tightly bound and lead to creativity and ingenuity.
So this, we're not talking about a book that just describes grand structures from past great cities or their architecture. We're really talking about interactions.
Absolutely, and a phrase I used in the book, which was picked up by the New York Times reviewer, was the connective tissues of a city. So it's not the main arteries of a city or its main organs, its buildings and its roads and things like that. It's about the human activity and the kind of the human ant heap or the human hive. It's how those people come together, the different places they interact, whether it's Roman bathhouses or coffee shops in 17th century London or food markets in 9th century Baghdad. It's about all these, you know, these things that make a city hum, make them alive and throw people together into the sort of the vortex of urban living.
In all of human history, you argue, it really is the city that has done the most to shape humanity.
Yeah, I think so. It's quite a big claim, I guess, but I think it's when people come together. So if we go back to what you mentioned earlier, the very first kind of city, which was Uruk in southern Mesopotamia, which is now southern Iraq, in the marshlands of southern Iraq. Uruk is notable not just for being the first city, but it's the place where writing emerges for the first time. Accounting, mathematics, it's very specialized trades. So and the wheel. So a lot of the kind of the inventions and discoveries happen in an incredibly fast period of time in prehistoric Uruk. So there's a connection between the city and our leaps in ingenuity. You could go forward to a city like Athens, which was, as it proclaimed, open to the world, or at least open to the Mediterranean world, the Greek world, And by bringing people together, you spark lots of different kind of ways of thinking about the world. And that's only really done in an urban context where people are brought together from all over the Greek world and are given public spaces in which to interact. If ideas follow trade, and cities are hubs of trade and they're hubs of ideas. You look at Amsterdam in the 17th century, which was another city that was open to the world, had a lot of Jews who left persecution in the Iberian Peninsula and brought their business practices to Amsterdam, and other people who were fleeing various types of religious persecution go to Amsterdam, another densely packed city, and we get the beginnings of modern capitalism, the beginning of the stock exchange and things like that happen. These innovations happen when people are thrown together in a kind of in an urban setting. So yes, I think, yeah, you're right. That is the claim I make, that cities provide the conditions for our greatest kind of inventions and sparks of ingenuity.
Yeah, innovation, that's a key word in reading through the book as you pass from city to city, that innovation is the one thing that seems to make a great city.
Yeah, definitely. That happens at a sort of the grand scale, those big ideas I was talking about, but it happens at a sort of micro scale as well. That there's a great kind of cities call upon because they're big, scary, congested, polluted, merciless places often. And so it calls upon people to survive. So so an example I would give is a place I visited in Mumbai in India, the slum or urban village called Dhivari, which packs a million people into a tiny, tiny space, but it's full of people who have come from the countryside, but find ways to survive in quite a brutal city, and develop this place of micro enterprises, craftspeople, and there's a kind of exchange of ideas within this kind of urban labyrinth. Another place I visited was in Lagos in Nigeria, which is the fastest growing megacity in the world and could become a city, if current trends continue, it could become a city of 80 million people by the end of this century. And I visited a place called Atiba Computer Village, which was started out in the 1990s as a place of typewriter repair people who then made the jump into tech and working at kind of street level, repairing computers, doing software upgrades, buying, selling computers, exchanging ideas in just a couple of streets, really. And now it's the biggest computer marketing place in West Africa with a turnover of several million dollars a day. So it's that kind of innovation that sort of urban living sparks, even if it's on a very small level. It's something about the kind of the interactions of people, the competitiveness of living cheek by jowl with people that causes them to be innovative. And that scales right up to, some of the great sort of progresses in human history. I'd look at London in the 17th century, the coffee house finding, bringing people together, scientists and craftspeople, engineers, long distance travelers, merchants. And you get the beginnings of one of the things that underpins the modern economy, which is insurance, which came from a London coffee house at the end of the 17th century, the beginning of the insurance market. And that was done over a cup of the hot stuff in a London coffee house. And it's only because the city has these gathering places for people who bring different views of weighing the world and different experiences and combines that knowledge and throws it together that causes these kind of these leaps.
I can actually hear this in your voice too, this energy and that dynamism that you get in a great city. Yeah. These new ideas that come in, and they don't just come in, people coming in from the countryside, but people from other countries who bring new ideas, expatriates, for example. Yeah. All of this coming together, even as far back as Athens, you're seeing this.
Well, even as far back as the very first city, which did sort of, because it was a very yes, you're right, having that sort of energy that comes from city life, it sort of draws people into it. And throughout most of history, cities have had to draw people in from outside, because they're this is a good time to talk about this in a way, is that they are places that have always been disease ridden and needed excess population to make up the numbers. And they've also been very open places. A lot of cities have been around ports, or at least around crossroads of trade. So they have sort of drawn people in. And some of the good example of that is probably a neglected part of the world, which was once a very urbanized and very kind of energetically urbanized part of the world, which was Central Asia, which was a meeting point of people from the Indian subcontinent, from China, from the Mediterranean world, from the Greek world, from the Middle East. And there was a blending of the major religions of the world at the time, the known world at the time, and ideas of mathematics coming from China and India, different ways of doing things sort of coalesce in these crossroads cities, as I would call them, places that bridged the gap between distant parts of the world and allowed knowledge to blend. As long as the cities were open to that knowledge and had a value in them, they became these sort of places of learning. And a city like Baghdad in the 9th century, which became the mm-hmm. biggest and most important city in the world, was able to draw on these expatriates, people from who represented, you know, the best innovative parts of Central Asia, and combining them with the connections to the Muslim world and to the Christian world via the Mediterranean. So it's sort of the openness of these cities to bring in new people and new ideas, and to see them as kind of places that are networked. No city kind of exists on its own. It's only through the network that it sits within that we get this kind of this buzz of energy and creativity. And that's true from the very, very first city and all the way through. It's that openness that they have as a sort of cosmopolitan melting pot of ideas, people, cuisines often. It's a sort of, it is a blending place where the new can be injected and accepted, because I think cities have a kind of, well, successful cities at least, have always had a kind of openness to other people and to other ideas, and to be curious about them and to be tolerant of them. And I can't think of any city that's been very successful that hasn't had a mixing point, whether it's, you know, from ancient Babylon to ancient Rome to London or New York or Los Angeles, you know, of having this or even a city like Singapore, which has this vast range of people. It's that sort of constant clashing of ideas that happens in an urban environment, which is true throughout history and is true now.
Cosmopolitanism, this idea comes up in the book, and you've in fact talked about that. But the Greeks, for example, who truly thought that the natural state of humankind was a city. But then you have the other end of cosmopolitanism, which in the book seems to me to be Alexandria, where it's a bit more conformist.
Yes, I think so. Yeah, Athens was, although it said it was open to the world, the thing about Athens was it was very kind of, it sort of believed in the primacy of Athens. Yeah. And so it was really that we find that kind of the sort of true kind of fulfillment of that cosmopolitanism much later on in Alexandria, which was, of course, founded by Alexander the Great and then turned into a great city by his successors, where you do have a meeting point of, you know, people from Africa, Central Asia, the Near East, and around the Mediterranean world. But the difference Athens had, you know, as I see it, was a quite shabby city. And that shabbiness sort of meant that people spent a lot of time outdoors, and there was a kind of sort of exchange of ideas in the marketplace, in the agora, in a different kind of setting. Alexandria was different because it brought people together, but it institutionalized that knowledge in academic institutions like the Library of Alexandria. So it was open to the world's scholars and the world's knowledge, and created the library sort of aimed to distill and translate all the world's knowledge in a sort of institutionalized kind of way, whereas Athens was a bit more ad hoc. It was a conversational city of people sort of being thrown together in that way. And then you get different kinds of learning. Athens was a place of kind of radical political and dramatic kind of leaps forward, whereas Alexandria was much more focused on things that were politically safer, such as medicine and engineering, much more kind of, you know, academic subjects like that. But it was certainly on street level, Alexandria would have been a true cosmopolis, a cosmopolitan city. And as I said before, that kind of idea of a crossroad, a genuine crossroads where people are sort of thrown into this dynamic interaction.
This is Think. I'm John McKay, and today for Chris Boyd. Metropolis, A History of the City, Humankind's Greatest Invention, is the name of Ben Wilson's new book. Our conversation resumes after this break. This is Think. I'm John McKay, in today for Chris Boyd. Author Ben Wilson is here talking about the history of the great city, as detailed in his new book, Metropolis, A History of the City, Humankind's Greatest Inventions. Ben, each of these cities that we've talked about so far, they all learned something from each. They may not necessarily be friends, I mean, over the decades, but they all learned something from each other. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. I think there's a kind of continuity through from the very first city, in Mesopotamia through to the cities of the Romans. There was a kind of constant sort of learning and transmission of ideas of what it was to be urban. There was the blueprint of the city could be carried further afield, and a lot of these ancient empires were primarily urban empires. They were cities of network cities that connected to each other. So an early example was the Phoenicians that carried the idea of the kind of the city from the Phoenicians being on the kind of coast of what would today be modern Israel, Lebanon, Syria, carried their kind of cities and in their ships and spread them to places like Carthage, Lisbon, Cadiz, and throughout the Mediterranean, and gave, you know, bequeathed those, a lot of those ideas to the Greeks, who took their cities and planted them. And they had the idea of the word metropolis meant mother city. It was the kind of the city that then planted other cities, like a big sort of seed head blowing its seeds and planting them further and further afield and connecting back to the sort of the mother city, back to the metropolis. The Romans, of course, carried it even further to places that had never seen anything like a city, such as Britain, on the sort of the wild west of the known world, which had never had any kind of large urban settlements and didn't seem to have any needs of them. So they had kind of Mediterranean city style, you know, Mediterranean city types kind of planted, as it were, in alien soil. And then so all, you know, lots of trading empires and things like that have bought and taken cities, and they've kind of found a kind of, it blended into the local areas, the local, you know, the places where they've been planted, in the kind of synthesis with other urban cultures, perhaps. But taking that sort of essential idea of innovation in the way that cities are done and taking them and spreading them around the world has certainly been, yeah, a big part of how urbanization has happened. It has been oftentimes an imperial project, and it has spread through trade, through the long distance trade, has always found these connections and different types of city. You know, we find ancient Greek city types appearing in Central Asia following Alexandria's army. So it's, you know, it's this constant sort of synthesizing of ideas across very, very large, you know, areas of the world.
You know, the Baghdad metropolis that you describe in the book doesn't so much resemble what we hear about in the news today, but this was a place of real innovation, and academics from different parts of the planet encountering each other and these are people from different traditions and sharing a world of ideas.
Yeah, absolutely. I doubt we would have had the what's called the European Renaissance without a city like Baghdad, which was able to collate ideas and bring scholars together from large distances that were influenced by, well, it was influenced, what made it happen was the idea, was the bringing of paper to Baghdad, which allowed information to be recorded and transmitted in an entirely new and cheaper way. And those ideas come on those trade routes that come down the Silk Roads from China through the great cities like Merv in Central Asia, countries like Uzbekistan, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan. This was a place of great cities and great learning. And paper arrives in Baghdad, and Baghdad was a city of markets and food and and commodities that had been bought from China, from the East Indies, spices, different ways of cooking and things like that, but also different ways of seeing the world. So there's a real connection there between Baghdad's kind of primacy in the world as a sort of economic player and its ability to attract scholars. And then for those scholars to be able to record their works in books and sell them in the famous book markets of Baghdad. And it's those ideas that then spread throughout the Islamic world as far as Spain, and which are then sort of adopted by Europeans as they begin to urbanize from about the 13th century. So Baghdad was this incredible city. It was a planned city. It's at its center was this perfectly round city. And it was designed to be that way, as the center of the universe, as this perfect circle. And in the center of the circle was the Caliph's palace and a mosque. And then raiding out from that circle were other sort of important military and religious and scholastic people. And then it went melded into the wider city, and each road connected to a different part of the sort of distant empire. So it was designed to be a kind of magnetic force, drawing in ideas and traditions and things and goods. It was a city that really kind of reveled in stuff. And I sort of tell that story from a shipwreck that was found off Java in the late 90s, which contained something like 50 or 60,000 pots. This was like a sort of cheap container ship that went down. It was bringing very cheap commodities that were produced in Chinese factories to be sold in the markets of Baghdad, which wouldn't have been found on a sunk ship. It would have contained lots of spices and other kind of delicacies bought from China. So that sort of shows the economic power of a city like Baghdad, that it was able to spread its networks over such a vast distance and bring with it the tasty food, but also the tasty ideas that could be kind of consumed altogether in a city of that power and magnitude. So it's a fabulous city to write about, you know, as a place of gastronomy, but also a place where of ideas as well.
You know, Lisbon expands this idea of trade. One of the key interest places of diverse people coming in from all over the planet. In fact, you refer to Lisbon as Museum of the World at the end of the 15th century.
Well, it was certainly the Museum of Europe. I think what was interesting about Lisbon, because Lisbon was a very kind of poor city in a poor part of Europe. It was kind of looking out to the Atlantic and had never really hadn't sort of prospered for a long time, but it saw its future in the Atlantic world and particularly in finding a way to tap into the great wealth that was the kind of the Islamic urban world. And so the merchants and traders and kings of Lisbon spread their tentacles further and further out into the Atlantic and then down the African coast and then into the Indian Ocean, where they discover a very kind of mature, millennia-old network of trade that crisscrosses the Indian Ocean, but also great cities, a huge amount of sort of enormous, very cosmopolitan cities that kind of drape themselves like a kind of pearl necklace across the Indian Ocean and connect to the big Chinese ports. But Lisbon became the kind of Museum of the World because it connected Europe, which was very kind of cut off from the kind of the urban heartland of the world and the trade networks of the world. And it exhibits these kind of curiosities of things that have been discovered, of tales that were told and brought from around the world, and things that Europeans who were very kind of hemmed in by the Islamic Empire and weren't long distance travelers and were very kind of insular in Europe. Suddenly the city becomes this kind of exotic place, and the architecture reflects it in this kind of it's buildings and monasteries and towers and palaces that were reflections of Indian and Far Eastern architecture. So it became a place where all anyone who was curious in Europe in the Middle Ages would want to go to, because it was this kind of bridgehead. It was this, you know, jumping off point to a wider world that most people had never even imagined before. And there, then there it was, kind of on the streets. You could see elephants on the streets, other exotic animals. You could see Africans, which was a novel experience for people. But sadly, you know, we have to say, many of them were slaves. Some of them weren't. Some of them were traders. There was maybe an idea that Japanese people got as far as Lisbon. So from going from a sort of very kind of on the edge kind of European city, it became the center of the world in a way that it, it connects to Africa, then to the, and then to Asia, and then to the Americas. So, you know, it becomes, it becomes, it takes on a mantle of a kind of imperial metropolis almost out of nowhere, because it kind of, because the Portuguese go with their guns and fighting ships and are able to sort of shoehorn or crowbar their way into other people's trading networks. They get the kind of the wealth of the world, which in those days was spices.
Yeah, you talk about Vasco da Gama sailing out of Lisbon, looking for Christian kings. If I remember, the Pope had divided the world outside of Europe by a north-south line in the Atlantic. And so everything that's going to be east of that line that's outside Europe, Portugal gets to explore, and everything that's west of that, Spain gets to explore in the New World. And the Spaniards, they come across a Tenochtitlan and the Aztec Empire. And I understand from the book that Tenochtitlan at the time was bigger than Paris.
It was bigger than Paris. It was sophisticated in its urban planning. Everywhere the Portuguese and Spanish went at that time, they encountered cities that were better designed and more sanitary, and had longer traditions of urban planning than many cities in Europe. The example for the Portuguese was Malacca, in the Straits of Malacca, sort of near where Singapore is today.
Southwestern Malaysia, yeah.
Southwestern Malaysia. So when I said Singapore, I meant that Singapore has sort of taken on the mantle of Malacca as this sort of great trading place. But that was pretty much destroyed, captured and destroyed by the Portuguese, as was the cities in Central America by the Spanish. So a lot of the kind of the wonders of those cities, or the things that they could have taught us, were destroyed by disease first and then by actual vandalism. There was a transference of those cities from their own sort of longstanding local traditions, national or, you know, regional ways of building cities, and were replaced by a very sort of European types of cities and ways of urbanization. So, you know, there was a sort of turning point in the world where Europeans, because they're more militarily, technologically advanced, become dominant in the world, but also dominant over the world cities.
This is Think. I'm John McKay, in today for Chris Boyd. And even within Europe, we're seeing changes. 1492, Ferdinand and Isabella, that so many people talk about with regard to Columbus, were also the folks that expelled the Jews who went from Spain to Portugal. And Portugal does the same thing to them, which leads to them going to Amsterdam.
Yeah, and taking those kind of connections, those ways of doing business with them, that the city like Lisbon that had been very tolerant in its own way, let's say, and at least, you know, sort of used other people's knowledge and skills, becomes very intolerant and very dangerous place for Jews to live in, or anyone that wasn't, you know, orthodoxly Catholic. And they do go to other cities. Someone wrote that, you know, Lisbon's loss was Amsterdam's gain, that, you know, by expelling the brightest and the best, you know, that those kind of people will gravitate towards other urban centres. So the first city that was Antwerp, but then Antwerp, it gets taken by retaken by the Spanish after a long war. And then Amsterdam, which had been a fairly unpromising kind of city in the wrong place, because it doesn't offer natural advantages necessarily, but it offers the advantages of being tolerant. And its toleration, you know, brings free thinkers from England who were suffering their kind of religious persecution, from France, from Germany, the Jews from Iberia, from Spain and Portugal, So by sort of opening their doors and having that kind of that toleration, which was sort of remarkable for its time, it sort of kickstarts its own sort of incredible growth as a city of, you know, people coming from far and wide, and the city growing and growing and growing in the, from the late 16th through the 17th centuries, but also growing in sort of a spectacular degree of wealth. That sort of openness, combined with the kind of the military power of the Netherlands, its seafaring power, its ability to connect to markets in North America, in South America, in the Indian Ocean, and to China and Japan, it becomes a powerhouse of urbanization and innovative in its way of handling money and its banking and finance. It's that sort of innovation that takes place literally on the streets, that it's, you know, it's a place where people wheel and deal, strike bargains, and the city's as much a kind of information processing center as it is anything else, because it's bringing people from such sort of distant places with very different ways of approaching the world and blending them together. But it's that only really works as a city if the city's also open-minded in the way that Amsterdam was.
One of the words that you use in talking about a great metropolis is sociability of a city. You cite a couple of cities within the United Kingdom as being at the opposite ends, London and Manchester. Can you explain that?
London, I write about as a city of sociability. So in throughout the book, I use cities not just to write about those cities in themselves, but to write about an aspect of urbanization that I think those cities best exemplify. And I think what London did, or the way that London developed from the 17th century, again, it went from being quite a marginal small European city to being the biggest city in Europe and then the world in a very, very short space of time from the 17th century through the 18th century. What it was characterized by was a commercial leisure, that it was a place where coffee came to first in Western Europe, came to from Constantinople. So we have the birth of coffee houses, where men came together to discuss and talk about ideas. This was a new kind of commercialized public space. And there were also theaters, pleasure gardens, clubs. There were all kinds of things baked into the city, not just having people in the city of different backgrounds. It's finding ways to bring those people together. And the coffee house, or that kind of idea of a city as a place of sociability, definitely crosses the Atlantic, goes to the British colonial cities in North America. So there's a sort of idea of, sort of, London represents this sort of changing idea of what it is to be urban and urbane.
This is Think. I'm John McKay, and today for Chris Boyd. Author Ben Wilson is with us, chatting about his book, Metropolis, A History of a City, Humankind's Greatest Invention. Our conversation resumes after this break. This is Think. I'm John McKay, and today for Chris Boyd. The book Metropolis, A History of the City, Humankind's Greatest Invention is our topic. Author Ben Wilson is with us. You were talking about London and sociability, but at the beginning of the 20th century, industrialization really doesn't seem to make cities a place where folks want to move to.
No, but they do move there in huge numbers, but they are... Cities like the cities I use as an example, Manchester and Chicago, cities that grew at a phenomenal rate and changed the world, really, in the way that their techniques of mass production, in Manchester's case of clothes, in Chicago's of food. All those things changed the city, but they also change other cities. So, you know, the techniques of mass production and being able to feed people mean that cities can become bigger, support larger populations, but they also by the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, the city is seen as almost having reached a point of collapse, that it's a dirty, crime-ridden, polluted, disease-ridden, and people are kind of looking for, you know, an alternative to the city, or a new kind of city. In England, there's the idea of the garden city, of kind of moving people out of the the metropolis, which has reached a point of almost terminal decline. In America, you have the things like the City Beautiful movement, ways of sort of reconceiving the city as a reaction against the industrial city, which has become a sort of Babylon of the modern world, a place of smoke and dirt and squalid living and stunted life. I mean, the industrial city sort of literally reformed people's bodies, made people much shorter, shortened their lives. Cities, Manchester and Chicago, had life expectancies, I seem to think, of about 26 years old. In the countryside at that time, it was 40 years old, your life expectancy. So we see, you know, huge child mortality and shortened lifespans and much more miserable ways of working and living and being in the city, which is, oh, just to remind us, I've given so far given a very positive kind of case for the city, but the cities have been loathed throughout history. They have been places that have been hell on earth for a lot of people. But the industrial city really showed in its sheer sort of size, the growth of these cities, their congestion, their inability for a city to plan for vast increases of population, kind of bring the city to almost to a point of complete rejection by people, that something had gone terribly wrong with how people had developed cities and thrown together factories and slums amongst what should be kind of an elevating idea of a city. A city is an almost sacred place. The city had become the opposite. People were very kind of amazed by the way the city had gone, that the city had been kind of abandoned by its middle class and upper class residents. They'd fled for the countryside or the suburbs, leaving the city as a cities like Manchester and Chicago as places that have sort of benighted, grim places. It changes. You know, there's films like Metropolis by Fritz Lang. The city had become this hell on earth for people, and a kind of thing that devoured things, like a kind of Old Testament pagan god kind of devouring its own children. It's this reaction against the industrial city that sparks a kind of the quest for a new kind of city, whether that's realized in Baron Hussmann's idea of Paris, of re-sculpting the urban landscape to make it much more livable, much more elegant. But that involved ripping up the old city. But it also, you know, in other ways of reconceiving the city, Chicago kind of leads the way with the beginnings of skyscrapers, which is taken on in a much bigger scale by New York. But turning the city in a way of kind of discovering light and air again is to build upwards to create this new city. And that's taken on by the kind of the modernists, people like the Swiss architect Le Corbusier, the very influential ideas that the industrial city had to be torn down and rebuilt. You couldn't just sort of keep on building over this kind of ruined landscape in a way. But that reaction against the kind of the dirt and squalor of the industrial city leads to a new kind of urban blight and urban problems, which are a sort of attempt to kind of create a utopian city, go horribly wrong. Though cities were destroyed in the Second World War throughout Europe and Asia, the cities that were rebuilt as a reaction against what architects and city planners saw as the failures of the 19th century was a new kind of failure. The failure of housing blocks, projects that destroy what's at the sort of the heart of urban communities, which is this, you know, or the heart of urban success, which is the idea of community, of the ways that people survive cities is to form communities. So in writing about Manchester and Chicago, I wanted to emphasize not just the squalor, but the way that people coped with it, and that the way that people were able to construct self-help organizations within both those huge cities. There was a great tradition in Manchester, England, of left-wing socialist sort of agitation for better working conditions, for the creation of sporting clubs like Manchester United, which had become sort of world-domineering sporting industrial mega corporations, come from working-class communities. In Chicago, there's a tradition amongst German and other immigrant communities to build very tight-knit ideas of self-education, savings banks, demands for parks and open air spaces for working people in cities. So cities, even though they were hellish places to live, they do create ideas of community. And that idea of community was kind of laid waste in a lot of places in the 20th century. So it's a very interesting story, I think, of the ways in which we kind of see cities as horrific without kind of looking beneath the surface to see how the kind of the seeds for recovery in cities are often at grassroots street level amongst people who live there. And this idea that you can impose a better city upon them from above really characterized a lot of the late 19th and 20th centuries. And it ripped the heart out of a lot of cities.
Can a great city be destroyed? I'm thinking of the Nazis' attempts in Warsaw or Carthage with the Romans.
Yeah.
So can you actually destroy a great city, or is it so resilient that in some form or fashion it comes back?
Well, I think the idea of resilience is key to what a city is, to the idea of urbanization. It's very, very hard to kill a city. When the Romans destroyed Carthage, they knew that they didn't just have to take away all the people, which they did, and sell them into slavery. They didn't have to just do that. They didn't have to just burn the city. They had to burn it and plow it over, because the cities always seem to grow back. The Romans knew that better than anyone else, that cities possessed this kind of resilience. Even then, Carthage did come back after a while. Hitler had a sort of similar idea. He wanted to destroy cities and wipe them off the face of the earth. He hated no city more than he detested Warsaw, which had, after New York, one of the biggest populations of Jews anywhere in the world. It had been the biggest Jewish city outside the United States. And he hated it and wanted it wiped off the face of the earth. He wanted Leningrad, St. Petersburg, and Moscow destroyed as well. A whole sort of, you know, urban world in East Europe and the Soviet Union. He wanted them absolutely destroyed, and which he tried his damned hardest to do. The one that sort of was that had the most kind of destruction was Warsaw, which was occupied, suffered the kind of the indignity and horror of the unpicking of civil society by a very brutal occupation. It had the Warsaw Ghetto, of course, which was completely was the place where Jews were taken and then taken out to be killed if they hadn't already died within the horror of the Warsaw Ghetto. The Warsaw Ghetto was destroyed, and then Warsaw itself, after the uprising of 1944, when the Poles rose up against the Nazis, Hitler ordered that every building be destroyed. And when the first people came back into Warsaw after it had been taken by the Red Army, found a city that had suffered almost complete and deliberate destruction. But Warsaw's still with us. The first thing that people did when they went back to Warsaw was to rebuild it brick by brick as it had been before. An incredible sort of organization from the ground of what people wanted. They wanted their city back and were able to rebuild it from old postcards, drawings. They literally scoured the world, every library, to find images of Warsaw or the central part of Warsaw to rebuild it as it had been before. So cities do possess this sort of incredible resilience. Right, you look at Hiroshima after it suffered the first atomic bomb, that the postmen were back at work the next day. People were reconnecting the electricity. Schools were happening outside. So people have a desire. People go back to the rubble and rebuild it almost instinctively. They value their neighborhoods. They value the traditions and history of their city. And they're the hardest things to wipe out, as the Romans knew with Carthage. There's always, wherever there's a memory of a city, it seems to come back, and people seem to have a desire to go back to their cities and to try and reconstruct them. I think that's quite a valuable lesson to learn in 2020 and 2021, when cities are also suffering, suffering badly, that the cities do possess this resilience, and people do have a desire to go back to what they knew before.
This is Think. I'm John McKay, in today for Chris Boyd. You point to Lagos in Nigeria as the metropolis of the future. It's expanding at such a fast pace. Is it its size and the pace of growth that has you looking at Nigeria and Lagos?
Well, China went through a kind of unprecedented urban revolution in the last decades of the 20th century, with hundreds of millions of people moving to the city. Africa's about to undergo its own demographic revolution on a magnitude that the world hasn't seen. Africa will experience population growth rates which are going to be extraordinary, and a rate of urbanization which will be truly astonishing. Lagos is a good example. Nigeria itself is the first African country to become majority urban. The rest of Africa will follow suit. So Nigeria is a good place to look. Lagos has grown from a city of about 250,000 people in the 1950s to probably a city, no one's quite sure how many people there are there today, but it's around 20 or 25 million. So that's a vast growth rate, and it will continue to grow. And you can see it growing if you go there. The people are arriving all the time from the countryside to seek their fortunes in Lagos, and for good reason, because it is a very successful city. It's oil rich. It's got a thriving film industry, a thriving fashion industry, a big hip hop industry. So it's got a lot of innovation and success stories, but it's also got a lot of people who work in what we might call a DIY economy, people who are working off the books. So people who are, who are surviving off their own ingenuity by creating micro businesses or selling things on the street. So it kind of represents two ways that cities are going, not just in Africa, but throughout the world, to my mind. You've got a business center of the city, which is building skyscrapers and becoming incredibly wealthy. And then another part of the city, which is growing and seeking to enjoy that joy, the wealth and making people kind of survive as they can within the city. And people go there people have gone to cities throughout the history of the world since there have been cities. People go there for a better standard of living, and they may not find it in the first generation, but it often happens with better educated children, more opportunities for business, more connections that you find in urban areas, and more access to healthcare and things like that. But Lagos is a very brutal city in that there's not much. You don't have many people looking out for you unless you create networks and find a way to survive within the city. But that's how a lot of people are going to have to survive in cities in the 21st century, which will be a century of cities, whether, COVID or no COVID, the city will be the most important fact of the 21st century in terms of how people live and its impact on the climate. And Lagos is a good example because it shows how people are existing in all kinds of ways in the city, whether they go there to seek the fortune or just survive on their own, and escaping the rural poverty and the lack of the sort of collapsing number of jobs in rural areas and having to find a home in the city. So it's a city of massive contrasts and huge strains on the urban infrastructure, on people's mental health, on their safety and quality of life. That Lagos really exemplifies all these things as a very fast growing mega city in a very fast urbanizing part of the world. So we should all be very interested in those places because they will have an impact on not just on Africa but on the globe, and especially in terms of climate change.
Ben Wilson's new book is Metropolis, A History of the City, Humankind's Greatest Invention. Ben, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's been a huge pleasure. Thank you so much.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think. Use any podcast app to get the Think podcast, or go to our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm John McKay, in today for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.